It is our custom to pause a few moments for silent prayer before we begin our services. This affords you the time to inventory your mind and see if there are any unconfessed sins in your life that need to be confessed to the Father, and to make whatever mental attitude adjustments are required for concentration upon our study. Shall we pray? Father, we are indeed grateful to you for this time of year when we reflect back upon those who have served this country in the armed forces. We are presently exercising the freedoms that these individuals protected for us on varied fields of battle. We salute each and every one of them for the service that they gave to the country, for their courage under pressure, for their devotion to freedom. And as we proceed with our study this morning and amplify one individual in particular who carried the torch of freedom and never let it go, even though he was in the environment of slavery, may we be more aware of the freedom we presently enjoy because of those who gave up theirs in defense of the colors. And we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. The gentleman that you see in front of you, the portrait, is that of Charles Major Shaw. He was a member of the United States Army Air Corps during World War II. Charles Major Shaw epitomizes the indomitable mindset of the American fighting man during World War II. Shaw was navigator of a B-17G bomber assigned to the 31st Bomb Group stationed at Polbrook, England. The B-17s were famous for their aerial bombardments of German factories and produced war material for its army and Luftwaffe, the Nazi Air Force of World War II. The B-17G was the most advanced strategic bomber ever deployed, with a wingspan of 103 feet 9 inches, four supercharged engines, a range of 2,000 miles, and 13 12.7-millimeter caliber machine guns, it exemplified its title of the Flying Fortress. The B-17G could cruise as high as 35,800 feet while carrying a bomb load of 6,000 to 17,600 pounds, dependent upon the length of the flight, a crew of 10, and could sustain abuse to the extent of losing three of its four engines and still return to base, that is, if it was not shot down first. Shaw took off with other members of his crew at 7:08 on the morning of 9 October 1943. He was in this B-17G, his nicknamed the Cue Ball. The mission's main target was an aircraft plant in Danzig, but the crew of the Cue Ball was to divert the Luftwaffe by feigning a direct attack on Berlin and then fade and hit Anklam so as to draw enemy fighters away from Danzig. Now, you can look at the map that I've provided for you, and you can see where Royal Air Force Base Polbrook is located in England. And these B-17s would take off there, and they would fly to varied targets, and gradually, as the war moved forward, they would penetrate deeper and deeper into Germany. And on this particular mission, Major Shaw was the navigator on the Cue Ball. All of these aircraft had their interesting nicknames. And it was the 25th flight, as we'll note in a moment, for Major Shaw, as well as others as members of his crew. And if they had returned to base, then they would have completed their mission and would have been free to return to the States. As they came in from England, Shaw's aircraft feinted toward Berlin to draw aircraft away from another section of the advance that was going to go straight to Danzig and bomb a plant there that was involved and manufacturing parts for jet engines. And the American military knew that if the Germans ever got to the point that they could produce jets, that we would be outmanned in the air, and therefore, as a result of that, we simply could not win the war. And so it was imperative that these manufacturing plants be destroyed, but that came at a very high cost of personnel, because the Luftwaffe still had their aircraft, and they began to intercept incoming aircraft that would come into the German area, and there would be these fights in the air, and both sides lost quite a number of planes. But nevertheless, the loss had to be tolerated because they couldn't be allowed to achieve their goal of providing jet aircraft to their Luftwaffe. And so this flight is coming into Danzig to bomb one of those very critical manufacturing plants. And as the feint to Berlin was accomplished to draw some of those aircraft away from the main flight here, then the cue ball went over to Anklam and bombed a factory there. And our story will pick up at that point as we see all of these events proceed. Anklam, Germany, was a small town which is northeast of Berlin, about 30 miles south of the Baltic coastline. And this attack was to be the deepest penetration into enemy territory by the 8th Air Force to that date. Upon sighting their target at Anklam, the cue ball was attacked by Luftwaffe fighters, one of which hit the gas tank on the right wing just after the bomb load was released. And you can see the result of that particular exercise. They did release their bombs, and they did hit the target, but almost simultaneously they were hit by one of the German aircraft. The mission was accomplished, but once fire erupted in the wing, the ability to return to Polbrook was lost. Almost all of the members of the cue ball's crew were on their 25th and final mission. Up to this point, only two crews out of the 36th and the 351st had made it to 25. The cue balls would not become the third. Hit with a 20-millimeter cannon shell, oily liquid fire burst into the cabin as flames consumed the plane, and the plane's pilot, Harry Morris, ordered bailout. The 10-man crew plus a photographer began bailing out as the plane's interior filled with a dense smoke. Charles Shaw followed bombardier Bob Fisher out into a bright blue sky. It was his first ever jump, and it would deposit him into Nazi Germany and ultimately into one of its POW camps in occupied Poland. When he pulled the ripcord, he was head first toward the ground, as if he had dived into a pool. When the parachute opened, it snapped Shaw's body upward with such force that his boots were pulled off his feet. As Shaw floated downward above him, the cue ball exploded into a ball of fire and disintegrated. As he neared the ground, the residents of a farmhouse observed his descent. A few seconds later, he touched down in a meadow on the opposite side of that house. Hay stubble quickly cut into his sock feet, and they began bleeding. As he hobbled down the side of a nearby road, the farmers apprehended him at gunpoint and assembled some of his crew members at a farmhouse, and they were marched into the nearby city of Anklam. An angry crowd assembled and began to hurl invectives at the four captives. A few minutes later, Luftwaffe soldiers arrived, dispersed the crowd, and sent out search parties for the other members of the crew. And finally, 10 of the crew were loaded into a truck and driven to the outskirts of Anklam and put in jail. Now, this transparency shows World War II Germany, and it documents Shaw's travels during this period of time. You will see this slide and this map several times during our study, which, by the way, will go into this coming Wednesday. To give you some idea of what I have here, is I have a book that was recently discovered by Pete in his father's belongings that I don't think Pete knew existed up till that time. It's a manuscript that he had hoped would be utilized to express his view of what went on in World War II and his part in it. More details about that later. But nevertheless, Pete allowed me to have the manuscript, and I've gone through it, and I have excerpted what I think are some of the highlights of it, and that's very difficult to do because the entire book is a highlight. To give you just a little bit of a heads up, Charles Shaw escaped from German prisons on 7 different occasions and was successful on the 7th. I'm only going to discuss a couple of those. But the ordeal that he and his fellow prisoners went through are something that I don't think we know much about. We're certainly familiar with the POW experiences of the Vietnamese POWs in the Hanoi Hilton and other prisons in North Vietnam. We've heard about POWs in all wars. But there were some events that went on during World War II perpetrated by Germany on our captured soldiers and airmen that I don't think is widely known, and you will learn it from this book. And in this, we're going to learn quite a bit about courage and the indomitable spirit that is necessary for winners as they engage the enemy on the battlefield. And these literal battlefields give us the idea of the kind of courage and determination that we need to fight the invisible war. The concept of never, 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 never quit is the idea. Nevertheless, you can see here Anklam at the top, a little red dot, and the target was Danzig on the right, which is Poland and not shown on this map. The places that he will visit will include Oberursel, and that's the first place he'll go, and then down to Zagin, Poland. That's where his first camp will be located, and he'll spend a good bit of time there. There will be a death march that we will note. There'll be a death ride that we will note. And there are other cities down toward the bottom that we'll get to later that have these POW camps or are a point of interest in the study. So this map and the locations you see indicated there will pop up time and again during our study. So the next day after they were captured, they were transported by rail to Oberursel, located 8 miles northwest of Frankfurt, and was the home of Dulag Luft, the greatest interrogation center in all of Europe. German intelligence had done a masterful job of sleuthing extensive data on American and British personnel, as Shaw was to discover when interrogated by Inspector General Hauptmann Müller. He knew not only the details of Shaw's duties, but the 8th Air Force, but also personal information, including his attendance at Clayton High School, Washington University, and even the name of his wife, Joyce, including her maiden name, Schoenbeck. So he's sitting there in this man's office, and the man knows all of these personal details, not only that about his unit, but also his family. That's got to be unnerving. The one crewman on the cue ball, Bombardier Benjamin Fincher, had up to this point avoided capture and became the subject of intense questioning by Mueller. Shaw repeatedly insisted that he knew no one by that name. Mueller knew Fincher was on the B-17 that crashed and wanted to learn his whereabouts. Obviously, Shaw didn't know that, but he also refused to verify that Fincher was even in the country, let alone on the cue ball. See, you only tell name, rank, and serial number. You don't give them any information except that they already know. One of the major compliments that American and British POWs voiced was the inability to brush their teeth. That's one of their major complaints. Mueller, in an attempt to break Shaw, had a guard offer him a toothbrush and tooth powder on the condition that Shaw would confess his knowledge of Fincher, and Shaw refused. 2 days later, Mueller approached Shaw for the last time. "Captain Shaw, I'm sorry you did not earn the toothbrush. Now it is too late. We have captured Mr. Fincher. We have no need for you now. It has been a pleasure to have had you as our guest. Well, Shaw responded, well, if it's been such a pleasure, how about letting me just have the toothbrush anyway? Mueller paused for a moment, then shook his head and said, impossible. There will be other Shaws and Finchers. And Shaw's departing shot was, fine, then you can have your old toothbrush. By the way, had you had toothpaste instead of powder, it would have broken my spirit. Later that day, Fincher was brought into the compound and the 11 were together again. The prison experience separated them, however, as each man soon discovered that he was now on his own. On the home front, Joyce Shaw awaits news. Charles Shaw was the son of former Clayton Mayor C.A. Shaw. Charles had recently married Joyce Schoenbeck, also a Clayton resident, and who lived with her in-laws while Charles was deployed. Ambivalence perfectly describes the mental state of a wife whose husband has been classified as missing in action. Encouraged that he was not necessarily killed in action, but anxious not knowing the exact status. And when a member of the 351st went MIA, it usually meant that he was either dead or a German POW. Joyce Shaw got some clarification from this by a letter she received on 24 October of 1943 from a family friend, Captain Harvey Wallace. Here's what Harvey wrote to her. I'm awfully sorry I didn't write or wire sooner. I'm not the least bit perturbed or uneasy as to their, meaning Shaw and his crew members, safety. They all bailed out over the continent, and the worst couldn't be more than a sprained ankle. The boys on the mission all reported to have seen 11 parachutes. They had an extra man on the mission, a cameraman. You should be receiving word from Charlie any day now. This is possibly the toughest job I have ever had. I know how hard it is for you people back there. He was in England writing. Of course, Mrs. Shaw was here. For you people back there to understand, but to try and explain so that you know the truth is pretty hard to do. If Charlie and the crew are taken prisoners, they will be treated as the best. He was an officer. Check with the International Red Cross for a confirmation of that. Also have them check to find out if Charlie is a prisoner of war or not. I only wish there were something that I could do that might make your worry end. Charlie will get a letter or message back to you as soon as it is humanly possible. Charlie is a winner, so please don't ever worry about him, and I know he will come back to you safely. I remain, as ever, Harvey. The official word of Charles's status as a prisoner of war came in a telegram to his parents from the War Department and published in the Star Times on November 15th of 1943. Charles's first contact with his wife was written on November the 12th, but was not postmarked in Germany until the 25th. It is not known when this wire was received in Clayton by his parents and also, therefore, by his wife. And here's the short message that he wrote. I am all right and safe. I was shot down on my last mission. The Red Cross is doing a wonderful job of looking after prisoners. See that Joyce is happy and that she enjoys herself. Try to make Joyce forget about this war. Someday I hope to get home again. Major. His middle name, and it's the family name, is Major. He also had that rank. Charles was in German captivity for over a month before he was given the opportunity to write. However, it was firm confirmation that he was alive and well, although a German prisoner of war. I am pleased to have visiting with us today in our congregation the widow of Charles Shaw and the mother of Pete, Mrs. Joyce Shaw. We're pleased to have you with us today, Ms. Shaw. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much. Well, no, we thank you. We make a practice of thanking the wives of service members, Ms. Shaw. They fight quite a good battle themselves back on the home front. You did that as well, and we thank you for your service during World War II. Thanks for being with us. We're going to take Charles down to Stalag Luft III in Zagan, Poland. We have our map back. Stalag is an abbreviation for the German Stammlager, which referred to a prisoner of war camp, while Luft indicated those used for captured airmen, Luft being the German word for air. So it's an air prisoner camp. Efforts to frustrate any attempts to escape were employed. The camp was outlined by two fences. This is a mock-up of it that's at a museum in Zagan, Poland. The camp was outlined by two fences made of barbed wire 9 feet tall and with an overhang at the top pointing inward. In between was a 5-foot no-man's land with a mesh of tangled barbed wire 2 to 4 feet thick. Guard towers stood in each corner of the rectangular compound with other guard towers spaced every 100 or so yards, manned 24 hours a day, and equipped with searchlights that scanned the area throughout the nights. The guards were armed with machine guns. A warning wire was strung 30 feet inside the inner fence, and anyone venturing into it was shot without warning. The barracks were about 75 feet to 100 feet long and 25 feet wide, containing 12 bunk rooms measuring 10 by 12 feet that accommodated about 15 men, 170 total. A hallway ran down the middle of the building. The wash houses contained cold water spigots where men could shave and take cold water showers, including the winter. Upon entering his assigned barracks, Shaw's first question to those he met was, "How are chances for escape?" What he got in return was stares, and he dropped the subject. Actually, the idea of escape did not look promising. Others had tried, and even those that got away were eventually caught and reincarcerated. Yet he believed it was his duty as an American officer to try. Shaw early on became friends with the Captain Powell of Birmingham, Alabama, who also believed that the impregnability of the camp, coupled with the arrogance of the Germans, created a challenge, one he felt should not be overlooked, one that, if thought about intelligently, could be overcome. Powell agreed with Shaw's assessment and said in his Alabama accent, "Charlie, God is on our side, and he won't let us rot in here. We must try our damnedest to get out of here or make the Krauts wish we were gone. What do we have to lose?" I can do a South Alabama accent. Now to the death march. In October 1947, in the edition of Foreign Service magazine, Captain Powell and Sergeant Dwayne Yarnell are quoted by Shaw from that article entitled, "We Drove the Germans Nuts." Here's what they had to say and what is contained in the article. "At Zagan, men were united by a single emotion, good old rip-roaring anger. The Germans had their arrogant guards, their guns and their high fences and their dogs. Yet, in the face of these odds, the Americans refused to be cowed into submission.
Your body could be conquered, but why allow the Germans to conquer your soul? You could let them drive you out of your mind, or you could fight back. Matching German intimidation with American ingenuity. So the Americans fought back. Escape, not a chance in a million. But why not give it a try? It gave you something to talk about while you hoarded food and made your plans. If you failed, rack up one for the Germans. But if you succeeded, you had the knowledge that thousands would grow drunk on your success. You had to think of American morale. If you did not, where else could you go except crazy? The same attitude motivated Charles Shaw to escape 7 times during his 18 months in and out of German POW camps. He was caught 5 times in his efforts to escape capture from Stalag Luft III. The next 2 would be in Germany, but not before one of the most horrendous acts of man's inhumanity to man on record, but which received little coverage in the aftermath of the war. As the Russians advanced into Poland from the east, the Germans decided that the several Stalags must be moved out of Poland west into Germany. So you've got Russians coming in from this direction, and you have to ask the question, how did they get involved in this? But nevertheless, here come the Russians, and they're beginning to encroach on western Poland. And so most of these POW camps were on the eastern side. And so the Germans decided they had to bring the POWs back into Germany and spread them out in the various prison camps they had in country. Now, these men are pawns. We'll get to it a little bit later, but Hitler had a plan in case things looked desperate toward the end, that he could use the POWs as bargaining chips, and that he would therefore offer these POWs for certain considerations if it ever came to that, and that if the Allies refused to cooperate, then he planned to kill them all. And this, of course, came out later. So when you have these prison camps in the western part of Poland and coming in from the over in the east side, headed west, the Russians, these evacuations began to occur, and that's where we pick up our study. At midnight on January the 28th of 1945, Stalag Luft III ceased to exist. Artillery fire to the northeast was audible when 10,000 airmen, flanked by helmeted SS soldiers brandishing machine guns, bayonets, and an assortment of weapons, marched single file out of the gates in Zagen. To strengthen their forces, several had Alsatian German Shepherd dogs. Each man carried his own homemade pack and one Red Cross package. Note the date, January 1945. That means the dead of winter. The first night was a ruthless drive into the teeth of a blizzard with temperatures dropping below zero. In the fresh snow, everyone was moving toward Spremberger, Germany, prodded, cajoled, and herded for 30-plus miles in 27 hours with only brief rest stops. Now, here on the map you can see I've plotted approximately where Zagen is in Poland, and they're moving due west to a community called Spremberg. That's a railroad site where they can put them on train cars. So they march them over there, but in a blizzard and sub-zero temperatures. POWs suffering from exhaustion and exposure reached out to sympathetic civilians only to be abused by the SS thugs as they berated the citizens for aiding the air criminals called Luft gangsters. Escape was not practical, as the guards were harrying, beating, or shooting stragglers who strayed out of line. prisoners of Stalag Luft III were joined on the road by 30,000 prisoners from other camps throughout southwestern Poland, many of whom Shaw knew that had been transferred there from Stalag Luft III. Shaw later wrote that the death march was grossly underplayed by Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force that was called SHAEF and was commanded by General Dwight Eisenhower. Here was their take. I have read reports where SHAEF attempted to explain away the Nazis' actions during this evacuation. They went so far as to say the Germans were protecting the POWs from the fire of their own forces in the combat zone. There is no justifiable explanation of the cruel and inhuman treatment suffered at the hands of this master race, end quotes. There should be no effort to sanitize this march. I know, I saw it firsthand. Many of our boys from our compound died in the march, while many others were shot, just murdered, plain and simple. I know, Burnell, that this thing's been over for a good long while, and I haven't studied the intricacies of World War II in the European theater for a good while. But as I go through Major Shaw's writings here, and as I do the research that some of the areas of the book required, I can't tell you how I almost became anti-German. Like, it's just unnerving the cruelty that these people were involved in. And for no apparent reason, you haven't heard anything yet. The first day of the march was an excruciatingly cold experience. Had those of Shaw's group not been able to obtain shelter, they would not have survived. As a matter of fact, no one in our group would have survived. None was strong, and Shaw had just taken a terrific beating, both physical and mental, during his fifth escape attempt. Now, he's got five behind him. I didn't bother with telling you about those. Worn out with brittle bones and frozen feet, the line halted in the middle of a small town. The American commanding officer, Major General Arthur W. Vanneman, was at the head of the column with Luft III commanders, Colonels Kennedy and Hatcher. Colonel Hatcher was also the commanding officer of the 351st Bomb Group. These three men combined their might in an attempt to influence the German captain leading this column to allow the men to find shelter. If we don't get these men inside, Vanneman said, they are going to die. The German officer's cold response was, "That is of no importance to me. All that interests me is getting my own soldiers inside." Finally, about 2,000 POWs were billeted inside a Lutheran church on the invitation of the minister. It was a beautiful little white stone church, much too small to accommodate so many. The men sat jammed up next to each other with absolutely no room to move. Those unlucky enough to be assigned pews were packed rigid and in total pain. You know, a pew's designed to kill you. The reason churches have pews is to keep you awake. So when you jam everybody into every possible square inch of a pew, they're in for misery, since we find out they had to do that over a 24-hour period. The men sat jammed up next to each other with absolutely no room to move. Those unlucky enough to be assigned pews were packed rigidly and in total pain. But body heat radiated throughout the entire church, and as uncomfortable as it was, the group managed to stay warm and sleep. The next day, the march continued for 2, 3, 4, or 5 days. Shaw couldn't recall. He found himself growing strangely lightheaded, unable to concentrate his thoughts or focus his attention on objects around him. It was all a bit of a blur. There were several times they did not think he could make it. They were given no water and ate snow when the Germans weren't looking. Sometimes they managed to steal a little hay they fed to cows. At night when they stopped, they melted snow, soaked the hay, and ate it. Once or maybe twice, the Nazis would give them black bread, cheese, and a pound of meat to be split among 50 prisoners. The men were so debilitated, no one argued over the size of their portion. And when the march continued, the prisoners walked with their eyes turned hopelessly to the ground. Charles literally began taking one step at a time, looking down at his boots, and therefore concentrating only on one step being taken after the other. He fell asleep several times while marching and feared injury. He only remembered picking up one foot and then placing it down, then the other, without being conscious of his surroundings. There were men being murdered all around. Eventually, this march ended in the town of Spremberg, where the prisoners were divided into groups and sent in different directions. Shaw's group was entrained to Moosburg, headed to Stalagluft 7A. Now, on the map, please note that there's been a death march for the however far, 30-something miles from Zagan, Poland, over to Spremberg. And now they're getting on a train. And they're going to head south down into Bavaria to a prison camp, Stalagluft 7A, at Moosburg. And the blue line that you see headed in that direction is going to entail the trip on that train. This three-day trip to Moosburg by boxcar was almost as wretched as the march. It was endurable only because some of them endured it. Shaw's description of what occurred over the next 3 days is incomprehensible to a civilized mind. Only from an eyewitness account by a person described by his fellow airmen as a man of establishment integrity and personal honor is it even possible to believe. Shaw's recall would be X-rated were it not for the fact that what he relates, he personally experienced. Here's what he told. We were crammed into the German pint-sized 40 and 8s. Little explanation of a 40 and an 8. These cars received their names because they could carry 40 men or 8 horses. Many Allied prisoners of war rode to German POW camps in these boxcars, sometimes with as many as 90 men forced into each boxcar. Remember, it's designed to hold 40. Millions of Holocaust victims were herded into similar boxcars on their way to concentration camps. Many POWs endured harsh conditions during their trips to POW camps, which sometimes included attacks from Allied aircraft. One of the problems in riding on a train during that time is that the American Army Air Corps would bomb trains en route to wherever, and therefore these people were in danger over this three-day period of being bombed by their own people. So we were crammed into the German pint-sized 40 and 8s. I remember thinking this car is full as the guards kept forcing dozens more to load. Some 40-man cars had 60 and 70 prisoners in them. You could not sit down. That was impossible. If your legs gave way, the pressure of the bodies next to you kept you erect. Our captors locked the doors and refused to open them for long periods of time, as much as 24 hours. We received no water and were allowed no opportunities to prepare food or relieve ourselves. Many were sick by now and had to vomit or defecate. You did it all where you stood. The vomit and human excrement accumulated on the floors and on those unfortunates unable to move out of the way. None of the cars were properly marked, and we were constantly subjected to Allied strafing and bombing, frequently delaying our movement. After the first 24 hours, they stopped the train in the middle of a railway yard, they said, for sanitary reasons. They ordered us out of the cars and told us to do our business right there in the open. If anyone moved out of sight, he was shot. While boxcars of prisoners relieved themselves in the yard, the SS allowed civilians to watch. The soldiers pointed, shouting that Americans had no culture. See, Americans are no better than beasts. They were pretty mad at us because we were breaking up their game in Europe. They wanted these civilians to believe we were not the superhumans that they were beginning to believe we were. I remember an SS captain explaining matter-of-factly, we were no better than the simple slaves and nowhere near the class of the German people. The brutalized soldiers in that yard, I'm afraid, proved his point. But I wonder if the civilians realized what these refined butchers had forced us to endure. The Germans repeated this circus throughout our three-day journey to Moseburg. During this march, every now and then, they would favor us with a sliver of canned salami. By the time we arrived in Moseburg, we were done in. Sick and hungry and packed in diarrhea stench, the exact toll from the march I do not know. Of the crew I knew best, the 200 men of my barracks at Stalag Luft 3, 6 died. Of the entire camp, I'm not sure. The thing that crossed my mind in reading this is that we're gathered here today utilizing a great number of privileges that we've recognized from our First Amendment: freedom of assembly, freedom of movement, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, free exercise. How is it we still have this? Jesus Christ controls history, but we do know that many times he controls history in order to employ punishment on those who rejected his word and rejected his provision of a savior. In the 1940s, we were a very strong, viable, energetic population. And apparently we understood that on two fronts, there were potential threats to the safety and the freedoms that we all enjoy. There were quite a number of people, millions actually, that served in World War II and fought in these two theaters. And you can see the horror that faced Western Europe had Germany been successful in moving through these various countries and conquering them and then beginning to systematically eliminate the less desirables, beginning with the Jews. What would the world be like had that been successful? We often wonder, did we really need to get involved in another continent's war? Well, the continent brought the war to us. The island of Japan brought the war to us. And that we were able to muster the wherewithal, the desire, and the determination to fight on two fronts indicates that at that period of history, in the souls of the men of this country, they were able to organize the wherewithal to fight, to die, and to make a stand for the freedom we enjoy today. And I hope as we move through this study, you will recognize and therefore reignite a flicker of appreciation for those who served so valiantly in World War II in both the Pacific and European theaters. When they finally reached their destination, they gratefully disembarked and marched into Moseburg and then into the barbed wire compound called Stalag Luft 7A. The next segment of our study is the Dachau concentration camp. And that's where we will resume our study at about 10 till the hour. Now we're going to dismiss our first session, and I'm going to ask Pete to join me out front in the Walk of Honor. You will note on the front of your bulletin we have three new pavers, they're called, that we will add to our Walk of Honor. They include David Heron, who is presently in Columbia. He is in Marine Corps ROTC, and in the coming months, I think in May, he will be commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. Secondly is Sean Wojciechowski, who is presently out in Washington, I think Fort Lewis. Is that correct? And that he will soon be deployed to Afghanistan, probably sometime in the month of December. He is an Army medic. And so Sean has a paver now to be added to our Walk of Honor. And, of course, Pete Shaw, who served in the United States Army as well. So you're dismissed to the Walk of Honor.